You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, UW professor talks about her new book of poems inspired by and written during MRI scans and other hospital visits. Now it's a brand new year and a popular time to set personal goals for the weeks and months ahead. Losing weight and getting in better physical shape are common resolutions. And if somebody just got you a new fitness tracker, well, you're ready to go. But there are some things you need to understand about how those things work. They may not be as helpful as you think they are, and they might not be right for you. Lisa Cadmus-Bertram is an associate professor of kinesiology at UW-Madison. She's also co-leader of the Cancer Prevention and Control Program at the UW-Carbone Cancer Center. Her areas of interest include physical activity and sedentary behavior and mobile technologies to promote health. Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon. It's great to be with you.
What do you see as the optimal use? If somebody has that fitness tracker, what is the best case scenario?
Fitness trackers are really great for people who want to get more awareness about their current physical activity level and those who want to increase their physical activity level, particularly for people who do the most common types of physical activity that, you know, are walking, jogging, cycling, types of activities that activity trackers can pick up well.
Do you see downsides? Do they motivate us in the wrong way sometimes?
Absolutely. So one of the downsides of fitness trackers is that they can exacerbate tendencies that some people have. So if you have had experiences in the past where you have been prone to things like disordered eating behaviors or compulsive exercise, you know, fitness trackers are similar to scales and diet tracking apps and all those other tools in that they can motivate us in really healthy ways. But there are a small proportion of people who might find those types of tools to be something that might trigger unhealthy tendencies. So we all have heard stories of people who can kind of become a little too obsessed with the tracker or letting their success with exercise or with diet tracking on any given day sort of dictate how the rest of their day goes. So certainly if you've had any of those experiences in the past, that might be something to watch out for and, you know, consider whether a fitness tracker, you know, might or might not be the best tool for you.
Let's stay with people in that situation. What might you recommend instead of a fitness tracker so that, you know, they still want to get decent, healthy physical activity, but without that obsessive risk, that addictive risk you were talking about?
Yeah, those are individuals for whom, you know, a more laid back or intuitive approach can tend to be the healthiest. So from a public health perspective, we're used to dealing with the majority of the population are people who can really benefit from more activity, who can really benefit from a deeper understanding of their activity patterns. For the people on the other end of the spectrum, sometimes more data is not necessarily going to be helpful. So these tend to be people who are already very health literate, already pretty vigilant about those types of behaviors. So then really just focusing on less data gathering, less monitoring can be really helpful, and really getting people to dial in and think about what types of activity they enjoy and really bring them, you know, peace, you know, might be getting back into nature, but really kind of focusing on some of those more emotional aspects of activity rather than the numbers can be beneficial.
Now, I'm in that bigger group. I think that you mentioned, Lisa, sedentary job. Many of my recreational activities involve sitting or standing in one place. I have found a fitness tracker. Keep saying tractor. Tracker makes me get up and walk around, go out for a walk more. How can somebody, the lazy person in my situation, make the best use of that fitness tracker?
Absolutely. So we recommend that people just wear the tracker for about a week to get a baseline sense of how active they are. A lot of times we're all so busy that we might feel really tired at the end of the day, and we kind of think, oh, I'm a super active person, I'm always on the go. But being really busy doesn't necessarily translate to getting the exercise that we really need to get in order to feel our best. So kind of getting that initial assessment is a really important first step, and then setting some goals. And we encourage people to, you know, try to avoid the trap of getting distracted by all the different types of goals that you can set and really focus on one thing. So maybe just focusing on steps or just focusing on accumulating, you know, minutes of physical activity per week, and to set goals over the short period of time. So January is a time when people tend to set long-term vague goals, like I will exercise more this year. When really a more helpful goal is to set a goal like, I will walk for 20 minutes after dinner, Monday through Friday of this week. So setting goals that are very specific and over a short time frame.
As we wrap up, Lisa, with or without a fitness tracker, it seems like the key here is motivation to keep going with exercise. Can you leave us with some encouragement to motivate us to keep doing something?
Absolutely. Well, oftentimes when we talk about exercise, we talk about long-term benefits, like reducing your risk of cardiovascular disease or cancer or diabetes, when often the way our brains work is that often we're more motivated by the short term. So sometimes we encourage people who are looking for that motivation to really focus in on the benefits that you're going to get right away, that it's going to help you let go of your work stress. It's going to help you feel more energetic, more relaxed, and kind of focus on those immediate benefits that you can get from getting up and getting out there.
Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Lisa Cadmus-Bertram is an associate professor of kinesiology at UW-Madison. We talked to her today about the pros and cons of fitness trackers. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy to tell us a story about a family of blacksmiths.
Wisconsin, four generations of blacksmiths work together creating art they hope will last for hundreds of years. The metal sculptures created by Boleslav Kohanovsky and his sons grace public spaces in Stevens Point, Door County, and beyond. Rob Menser has more.
When Boleslav Kohanovsky works in his blacksmith shop in rural Portage County, he thinks about his father. His dad was a blacksmith who apprenticed in Boleslav's great-uncle's shop in Zamość, Poland. When World War II came, he was rounded up by the Nazis and forced to work for the regime. But after the war, he and his wife came to Chicago. He got a job forging parts for train cars for the Chicago Transit Authority. Some of Boleslav's earliest memories of his dad are connected to that work.
I knew he worked with metal, and he smelled, the smells of metal were on his clothes, and I remember those smells. Smells a very strong sense, and I remember that as a very young boy of three or four, I suppose, and that was inspirational to me.
Boleslav became a blacksmith too. He started out doing structural steel, forging the bones of buildings. He loved drafting and working with metal, but he wanted to do artistic work.
The structural steel was basically anonymous work, and I wanted to do work that was not anonymous.
So Boleslav started to create decorative metal railings. He practiced expressing himself through the metal he forged. That was 40 years ago. Today, he works with three of his sons on metal sculptures and other art pieces.
This is the blacksmith shop. That's the forge over there.
The coals in the forge heat the ends of the iron red hot until it's malleable. For some tasks, they use a massive power hammer to flatten it. Other things they hand forge with a hammer and an anvil.
The forging is where the art happens. If you can't interpret it at the forge, it's nothing.
One of Boleslav's sculptures, an 18-foot spire with a flying crane, looks out over Egg Harbor. This summer, the city of Stevens Point unveiled his sculpture of the word point in the roundabout entering town. Even a smaller project like a railing can take weeks to complete, so the shop always has multiple projects in the works. In the next room, Boleslav's youngest son, Valerius, is drawing sunflower leaves onto a steel sheet.
We're gonna cut it out like this with like a plasma torch. And then I'm gonna put it in the forge, and then we're gonna shape it, put grooves in it, put it to life, yep.
Valerius's older brother, August, says they wanna use the unique qualities of the metal they work with.
So say for instance, I'm splitting a bar of metal, right? It's naturally gonna swell on the sides, right? I'm gonna let that show, or if I'm drawing out a piece of metal, I'll leave the hammer blows. And the iron just becomes a vehicle to express our ideas through.
Boleslav is deeply connected to his Polish roots. On the afternoon that he was showing me around his shop, a surprise visitor named Peter Semeniak dropped by from Chicago.
Yeah, I am vice consul in Polish consulate.
He was visiting in part because of the project Boleslav was working on that day. It's a piece meant to symbolize the friendship and connection between Poland and the United States. On two tall spires, two eagles are perched, a Polish white eagle and an American bald eagle. Bolesław still feels a connection to his great uncle's blacksmith shop in southeastern Poland, and he takes pride in the fact that his work will last.
When I was young, I couldn't believe it that cars, you know, rusted out like they do in that planned obsolescence thing. I really liked that locomotives were made and designed to go a million miles because they were built right. I really have the attitude that my work is time transcending, that it'll be around a very long time.
WPR's Rob Menser brought us that story on the art of metalworking. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, a Wisconsin poet joins the show with haiku she composed while inside MRI machines, at infusion centers, and in medical waiting rooms. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You may remember learning about, maybe even writing, haiku back in school. The poems, inspired by a Japanese tradition, look short and simple, but they can pack a lot of punch. Our next guest turned to haiku to deal with and to share her experiences with long-term illness and disability, starting with poems composed in MRI machines, infusion centers, and waiting rooms. Ellen Samuels is professor of gender and women's studies and English at UW-Madison, author of Fantasies of Identification, Disability, Gender, Race. Her critical work has appeared in a number of journals and anthologies, including Signs, Journal of Women in Culture and Society, and Feminist Disability Studies. Ellen's latest book is a collection of haiku called Hypermobilities. Ellen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Well, your book dives right into haiku, and I was hoping you could share some of the first section with us called Hypermobility.
Yes. So there's seven poems in each section, seven haiku, so I'll just read them from this first section. The first poem is called Hypermobility. No one is supposed to bend that far. No one knows why you don't just break. Baton hypermobility scale. Thumb, wrist, palm on floor. All the ways you go too far. Tally up your score. The difference between joint subluxation and dislocation. Door unlatched in the body house. Shutter to slow kiss the jam or slam. Hypermobility of the small joints. To press a button means fingers, muscle, past bone. Yes, no, enter, yes. Hypermobility of the large joints. If your legs were wings, they need to swing this far out, and feathers, and sky. Hypermobility of the large joints too. Don't climb a hill, then pick up leaves. Too much bending, I mean ambition. Hypermobility of the large joints three. The ankle joint is connected to the leg joint. That's enough for now.
Now, before we talk more about the poetry and how you wrote it, can you tell us a little bit about this chronic condition, hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, if I'm pronouncing that all correctly?
Yeah, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is named after the two doctors who first described it. So one doctor's last name was Ehlers and one was Danlos. It is an inherited collagen defect. Collagen is one of the building blocks of our bodies. So this collagen defect affects all the systems of the body in a variety of ways. But the most hallmark way and often the most visible way is that it causes what they call hypermobility in joints. The ligaments that are supposed to hold your joints in place are weakened by this disorder. And so joints can slip out of place, can, as they say, medically subluxate, which is like a partial dislocation, or dislocate just from the tiniest movement. Can dislocate my shoulder just, you know, turning over in bed. And Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is considered a rare disorder, but in recent years, it's being diagnosed much, much more often, and it's beginning to be thought it was more of an underdiagnosed but more common syndrome, rather than being as rare as was once thought.
You've been living with this for a long time, pre and post diagnosis, lots of treatment. What started you coming up with these haiku about it?
Yeah, it started in 2014 when I was diagnosed with a complication of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which was a dissection in one of the arteries going to my brain. I spent a lot of time in MRI machines, getting head and neck MRIs. And that's quite an intense experience in any case. But in my case, they were often, it was in a very emergency setting, which was more stressful. And it's very loud in the MRI machines. They give you little headphones with music, but you can't really hear the music because the machine is so loud. And I needed something to kind of hold on to get through these hours in the machines. And so I started to write haiku in my head because it was such a short form that I could write it in my head without, you know, being able to write on any form of writing implement. And I started doing that as well when I was getting other treatments, spending time in the infusion centers at the hospital with different drugs. And it just really helped center me and give me a sense of control when things felt very out of control. And that's why I really hewed very strictly to the 5-7-5 syllabus form, which isn't even, I think, by haiku experts considered quote unquote real haiku at this point. But for me, it was really essential to the experience.
When did this go, Ellen, from basically a coping mechanism to something you realized you wanted to share with the world?
Yeah, that's a good question. At a certain point, I started writing them down in a document on my computer and occasionally posting one on social media. And I think when I had about 20 or 25 haiku was when I started to think maybe these are more than a coping mechanism. Maybe I'm actually writing a book and it's kind of a memoir in haiku about this experience. I have an MFA in creative writing from Cornell University. I've wrote and published poetry a lot early in my career, but more recently I had not written and published poetry in a long time. And so it was probably, after a couple of years of doing this that I started to turn it into a book. And then it was just published this year, which I'm really excited about.
Talking to Ellen Samuels, professor at UW-Madison, author of the new book we're talking about, a collection of poems, haiku, called Hypermobilities. I want to talk about this for a couple different audiences, Ellen. First of all, for people with disabilities, what are you hoping that they take out of your, as you say, your memoir in haiku form?
I'm glad you asked that because, I mean, the disability community is the community that has sustained me through my experience both before and after diagnosis as a person with significant physical disabilities. And so for my community, I hope to say first and foremost, always, you're not alone. It's tremendously isolating to have any kind of disability, to have any kind of chronic illness. You often feel very cut off from the world. And so I see all my writing as different ways to connect with that community and say, you're not alone. Here's my experience. Is my experience useful to you? Just as so many others, writers' experiences have been so profoundly useful for me.
And then for people not dealing with a chronic illness or a disability, or at least not yet, I guess, Ellen, one line that stuck out in your afterword to the book, quoting, "I don't want to be pitied, but I also don't want to pretend everything is okay." That struck me. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's really the bind that you're in with any kind of chronic illness, I think, is that how do you answer the question, how are you? Beyond if you just you give the automatic okay, right? If you tell the truth, then the automatic reaction is some kind of pity or otherwise putting you, you know, assigning you to a category of someone who is damaged in some way. And that healthy people want to distinguish themselves from, right? We literally have, you know, expressions like there, but for the grace of God, go I, or like, you know, well, if I see that Ellen, with everything she's dealing with, you know, can do this, then I shouldn't complain. That seems like an uplifting sentiment at first, but it's actually a profoundly dehumanizing one in a way, because it suggests that we are not the same kind of people. And I just have to observe that I think this is true at all times. It was true when I wrote the book pre the COVID-19 pandemic, but certainly during the pandemic, it's becoming clear that we are all vulnerable. We are all physically, mentally, and emotionally interdependent, linked, and vulnerable people who cannot divide ourselves into the worlds of so easily of who's healthy and who is not.
In our last minute or so, Ellen, for getting back to others in the disability community now, would you encourage them to join you and I think a growing number of people with disabilities who are expressing themselves in poetry, in prose, in whatever form?
I do. I do encourage everyone to write or create in the way that works for you. There are, of course, Instagram poets. That's not something I could ever do, but I think if that works for people and it reaches people, it's great. I've had the great privilege of teaching writing in a variety of settings for the last few decades. And one of the most amazing things is to see someone who says, I've never even thought to write a poem in my life. What is a poem? And then by the end of the semester have discovered in themselves this rich, beautiful, poetic voice they didn't know was there. I think writing is a gift, but it's also a skill that can be learned and that everyone can do it.
It's a great place to leave it. Ellen, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing some of your poetry.
Thanks for having me.
Ellen Samuels is a professor of gender and women's studies and English at UW-Madison. We talked to her today about her new book of haiku poetry. It's called Hypermobilities. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, how has fatherhood changed during the pandemic? We'll hear from a Milwaukee Fatherhood Project, and you can share your stories too. Health writer Julie Rovner is back with us for a look at what options are on the table for the federal and state governments in dealing with the latest COVID news. And music can be good for us at any time of our lives, can really help us through the process of aging. We'll learn more from the authors of the new book, Music, Wellness, and Aging. That's tomorrow on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, about 10% of Americans have diabetes, and that number is growing. But insulin has only gotten more expensive and quickly. A doctor shares his research on why this life-saving medication is out of reach for many Americans. First, some of us might have made New Year's resolutions to be more on top of our finances. But things like budgeting, investing, and managing our money can sound boring or scary, and it can be hard to know where and how to start. Our guest today hopes to make it fun and easy to get on the path to personal financial well-being. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What financial goals do you have this year? What help would you need to reach those goals? What advice do you have for other people to manage their money? Was there something, a breakthrough you had at some point in your life that really helped you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Emily Guy Birkin is a financial coach based here in Wisconsin and co-author of the new book, Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management. Emily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I mentioned goals people might have for the new year. You and your co-author have an approach. You know, sometimes people might sit and write down goals. You say, yeah, sure, but do it as a timeline. How and why?
So timelining your goals is important because just writing down, like, I'd like to, you know, have $1 million for retirement. I'd like to pay for my kid's school. I'd like to pay for my daughter's wedding, you know, any of those sorts of things. It's a good first start because, you know, getting it out on paper, putting it in words is a really good first start. The problem is that these things have to happen at a certain time. And if you don't put it down on a timeline where you actually kind of write out, all right, here I am now, I'm 35, I want to retire in about 30 years. How long is that going to take me to save up the $1 million I want to have for retirement? You are going to have this big dream without actually having the steps in place to figure out when it's going to happen. The other issue with just writing your goals without timelining them is that you may have some goals that overlap. So if, for instance, you're closer to retirement, you're in your 50s, and you also want to pay for your children's college education, unless you sit down and write it out in a timeline, you might not realize, oh my goodness, I plan to retire in the same year that Junior is going to be in his third year at school, at college. How am I going to be able to afford both at once? So putting things in an actual timeline and like looking at the dates of when you'd like to have things happen, not only gives you the power to plan ahead and work around things that could be problematic, but it also helps you figure out, it naturally helps you figure out what's more important to you. So if you realize like, oh, you know, my kid's going to be in college, I can push back retirement a couple of years. That's okay. I don't mind. Or you could be like, no, retirement's really important to me. I'd really want to retire on time. What are other ways we could reach that goal to help pay for my son's college education?
Before we tackle some more practical advice, Emily, let's talk about the feelings we have around money. I know that's important to you. We've talked about it before. It's in your book. First of all, for those people who are maybe scared, fearful of confronting their finances head on and making that plan, how do you talk them down a little bit to set some of that fear aside and mm-hmm. start getting things done?
Yeah, one of the things that was really important to my co-author, Josal Sihai, and me was make sure that money is approachable. You know, so people who are interested in money are going to pick up money books every day. You know, they're interested in it. The folks who are feeling overwhelmed, intimidated, scared, they need something that is going to help them understand that money doesn't have to be terrifying. And so we wanted to write Stacked to be approachable, funny, fun, lighthearted, irreverent. And so that's one of the things that I also hope that readers will take away from it, that they can look at their money from a funny point of view, They can look at it instead of saying, for death, oh my goodness, it's terrifying, in which case they're going to avoid it. They can say, how can I make this fun? How can I enjoy managing my money? And changing that mindset so that they can look at it as something that they can find a way to really have fun with and jump into and be glad to be doing, instead of it being this very serious thing they have to avoid, is going to make a huge difference in their ability to manage their funds.
I'm another category, I think. My obstacle is when I start thinking about this stuff, it's kind of eye glazing and boring. And yeah, I know it's important, Emily, but how could somebody like me have fun with this stuff that I think of as, you know, about as much fun as, I don't know, flossing?
Well, it takes
which I do.
Small steps. Yes. So the thing about money is we tend to think of it as, with anything complex, we tend to think of it as like, oh my goodness, I have to devote 3 hours to it. And the thing is, consistency is more important than any length of time. So if, for instance, you want to do something like start setting up a money meeting with your spouse or partner, your accountability partner, your roommates, your best friend, just say like for 10 minutes once a week, going to go over what we spent last week and what we plan on spending next week. And so that makes it a lot less you know, eye glazing for one thing, because it's short. For another, because, you know, if you get something you consistently do, and if you do it with an accountability partner, you do it with someone that you care about, then it's a lot more fun also, because, you know, just sitting down to do it yourself, you're always going to find more interesting, important things to do, or quote unquote important things to do. So this is one way to really kind of make sure that you're doing the little steps that you need consistently, rather than feeling like you have to do it all at once.
Talking to Emily Guy Birkin, co-author of the new book, Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management. The super serious is kind of ironical there. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how to tackle your financial well-being, how to make plans, something super specific, or is there a piece of advice that really helped you somewhere along the way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Emily, you write in the book, there are a lot of these apps out there that help us track our spending, and we can track every single penny we spend. But you and your co-authors say that's not quite enough. Why not?
I used to work with a woman years ago when Mint was brand new, and she was saying she loved it because, you know, she had information and it would create these pretty charts that showed her all the ways she'd overspent. So she's like, ooh, pretty, and anything with the information. So the thing about all of this tracking is that that's just a piece of it, and that's the piece that's automated. What needs to happen is the manual part, which is where you look at that information and you decide what to do, what changes to make in how you spend, how you allocate money, or whatever you do money management wise, because otherwise you're just following along all this information and doing absolutely nothing with it. And in fact, one of my favorite pieces of presidential trivia is the fact that Thomas Jefferson was a fanatical tracker of his spending, but he died in terrible debt because he wrote down every single thing he spent money on, but it didn't change his behavior in any way. And so he just tracked his way all the way into debt.
If we are in that situation where we're tracking our money but finding ourselves in debt, how do we start to figure out where those leaks are, how we can stop doing the things that put us in debt in the first place?
So looking back over what you've spent money on, and that's where these trackers are great, the automated ones, the apps, mint.com, all of those. So looking back at what you have spent is really the best thing to do to figure out where your leaks are. So it's one of those things where it's very easy to forget how you've spent stuff. There have been times where I was like, I could have sworn I had about $100 in my wallet. You know, did someone, you know, steal from me? And then like all of a sudden thinking like, yeah, I spent $20 there. Oh, and about $40 there. Oh, yeah, I spent all $100. So if you've got something that's tracking for you, you can look at it, and they can be really helpful too, because they'll show you categories too. They'll categorize, and you'll be like, oh, wow, I spent $400 on takeout last month. That is where all my money's going. And then you can start thinking about that will remind you as you go forward, like, I don't want to do that again this month. So, you know, when you're thinking like, I don't want to cook, I'll do takeout. Then you can go, well, I don't want to do that again. So how can I make some food? What are some leftovers I can eat? What are some things I could do instead of getting takeout and building up that huge amount again?
Emily Guy Birkin is with us, financial coach, co-author of the new book, Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management. She's with us today for a look at personal finance and what we do with our money and how we can have some fun doing it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about budgeting or investing? Do you have advice of your own that you give people about saving, borrowing, when to do it, not to do it, how to get spending under control? You could join in at 800-642-1234, or if there's something you wished you knew when you were younger and you've learned it now, maybe you could help somebody else out. 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with financial coach Emily Guy Birkin. She's co-author of the new book, Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question about overcoming some hurdles that you find when it comes to trying to get a handle on your money, if you need some practical advice or maybe some motivation, or if you've got some advice to share, 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Donna is with us in Wauwatosa. Donna, hi.
Hello. Say, I just have something that I kind of learned the hard way when I was in my mid-30s. When I started a job that had a retirement plan, with a match, I put in whatever they would match. And then every time I got a raise, I would increase that my contribution by 1%. And even though I only started my retirement savings in my mid-30s, I was able to retire early at 60 because of that.
Donna, thanks so much for that call and for the first call of 2022. There's no prize for that, but it's interesting advice. Emily, there's a lot to be said for taking advantage of the interest you collect if you start saving early, right?
Oh, absolutely. There's the power of compound interest is really an amazing thing. And, you know, Donna's story is a good example of how that works. For one thing, you know, starting in your 30s means that your money has, you know, she retired at 60, 25 years to grow. And that's an amazing amount. For example, if something grows at 3.5% consistently, it will double every 20 years. And so, you know, if you just imagine that at 8%, which is the amount that the market historically grows per year. The other thing is the behavioral aspect of increasing the amount that you send to retirement by 1% each time you get a raise is fantastic because you don't miss money that you haven't had. So, and you still get to enjoy an aspect of the raise, you know, so that you know that you are always adding on to what it is you're sending to retirement.
Thanks a lot for that call, Donna, at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Scott next in Menominee. Scott, hi.
Hi. I was wondering how common is it for that you might come across in any studies or something that you might know about for people to just spend money that they don't have and get themselves in debt. It seems like kind of almost a no-brainer to me sometimes, but I wonder if you might have any insights on that.
And so, Scott, before I let you go, you've managed to avoid overspending, it sounds like you're saying?
I've got, you know, rent's coming, you know, this is coming, you got to have food coming. You don't know what the prices are going to be on some things like food or gas, but you kind of know it's coming. So you don't go elsewhere and buy something else, or, you know.
Well done, Scott. Thanks a lot for the call. Emily, I imagine most people are not like Scott, or a lot of people. There's a fair amount of us who overspend, right?
Yeah, overspending is very common. There's a number of reasons for it. One is not paying attention. You know, if you're not paying attention to your money, it's very easy to forget, you know, about what you've spent on already. So if there's any kind of lack of communication between yourself and your spouse. So Joe, my co-author, tells a story of he and his wife both came home having spent quite a bit of money. She had bought school clothes for their children and he had bought some video games. And he likes to point out there's no saying which was more important. But that had overspent because they hadn't had a conversation. So that's something that can often happen if you're not on the same page with anyone you're sharing your money with. And then there's also the psychological aspect of it. People may know that they're overspending, but they feel like they need the psychological boost that they get from shopping or from spending money on things. And the thing about that is it's important not to shame people for being in that situation because that overspending is fulfilling an important psychological need. And unless we recognize that and say like, hey, there's an emotional need there. Is there another way to fulfill it without spending money? You know, if we just go shame, 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 you shouldn't do that. That's not going to make the behavior get any better. And so all of those are some common spending. And I think it's really important for people to be gentle with themselves and figure out, you know, look at it with kind of curiosity, like an anthropologist, like, why on earth did I do that? Mm-hmm. Or in the case of a couple saying like, why did this happen? And how can we make sure it doesn't happen again?
Scott, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Emily, I want to hit that point a little harder because it's a theme that goes through your book. Look, we should look at our mistakes and not judge ourselves for them, but analyze them and learn for the future.
Absolutely. We all make mistakes with money. There is not a single human being on earth who has not made a mistake with money. And I'm including Warren Buffett in this. You know, all of us have done something where we're like, why on earth did I make that money mistake? Or I have put myself in a tough situation that I didn't need to be in because of a money mistake. And if we start from a place of anger, or shame or self-recrimination, that makes it a lot harder to pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and keep going. Whereas if you come from a kind of place of curiosity and go and a place of laughter, being able to poke fun at yourself for having made the mistake, that is going to make you much more open to the solutions that can really help you to make sure the mistake doesn't happen again, so that you learn from it, and make you much more comfortable with the fact that mistakes happen and you can bounce back from them.
We're talking to Emily Guy Birkin, co-author of the new book, Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management. Emily, let's say, okay, we've got those immediate needs met. We've got some money saved up for the things we want to do in the short run, and we're ready to try investing. And that opens up a whole new bunch of questions. How do we start to matchmake between our future needs and the zillion investment opportunities out there?
Well, one of the important things is to remember it's not about the zillion investing opportunities out there. You don't need to know about all of them. You need to know about the ones that are going to be right for you. And so that already narrows your focus. Instead of feeling like, you know what, I got to go get a PhD in stock market. No, you don't. You just need to know what's right for you. So that's part of where timelining comes in. So what's right for you starts with like, how much am I going to need and when am I going to need it? Okay, what kind of investments will get me to where I need to be when I need to be there? And then you can start asking yourself, like, how much risk do I feel comfortable taking on with my investments? What kinds of things provide a level of risk versus return that will fit with what I'm comfortable with? So it's much less intimidating than it needs to be. It's much more intimidating than it needs to be often. And one of the things that I liken it to is a little bit like the first time you out on a date, it's terrifying because you feel like, oh my goodness, I've never done this before and I'll die of embarrassment if they say no. But if you end up being very friendly and just chatting with people a lot and regularly asking people for coffee and just meeting new people, any one person you ask out is no big deal. So similarly with investing, if you get started with the idea like, oh my God, I have to get this right or everything will just fall apart, you're not going to feel comfortable with investing ever. So if you start with like, okay, I'm going to learn a little bit about this. I'm going to invest $50 because I know I can afford to lose $50 and I'll see what happens and I'll learn from that and then kind of keep going from there and grow and grow.
Time for one more caller. Randy is with us in Preston, Minnesota. Randy, hi.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. It just strikes me that as you talk about, you know, investing and dealing with your money and everything, it seems like you're kind of ignoring that about 70%, the last thing I saw, 70% of Americans or adults can't survive a $400 to $500 emergency. That it, mm-hmm. you know, their car breaks down and they can't get it fixed. They lose their job because they can't get to work. And I mean, stuff like that. And
I got you. Randy, we just have a minute or so left. And Emily, I know people in that situation are very much on your mind. Do you have some thoughts for Randy?
Yes, you're absolutely right. There is a huge number of Americans who cannot afford a $400 emergency. And that's exactly who this book is for. When you are living paycheck to paycheck, it can feel like it's impossible to get ahead. But the fact is, you don't need to get to a point where you're stable to be able to get stable. We want to tell people that even if you're living paycheck to paycheck, even if you're in a situation where you don't know how you'd pay for an emergency, you still can make changes to help you get ahead to the point where you feel a little more stable, and then you can get to where you can start thinking about things like investing and the kind of 201 level money stuff.
And just in our last half, thanks for that call, Randy. In our last half a minute, Emily, that brings us back to the point we started with. Wherever you are, be ready to confront your current money situation.
Absolutely. Make sure that you are ready to look at what the problem is and be able to deal with what the problem is, whether that's not having enough money, in which case, you know, figuring out how to deal with that specifically, or if it's a money mindset issue and figuring out how to kind of confront the way that you look at finances.
Emily, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Emily Guy Birkin is a financial coach and co-author of the new book, Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management. Coming up after the news, up to a third of Americans with diabetes ration their insulin because they can't afford to use the full dose. A doctor shares his research and some possible solutions. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.